We are discussing the COVID vaccine here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The two vaccines approved for use in our country are made by Pfizer and Moderna. They're designed to be given in two doses, 3 or 4 weeks apart. And the rollout comes as a more highly contagious variant of the virus has been detected in Wisconsin and other states and will likely accelerate the spread. It's according to the CDC on Friday that said people must double down on hand washing, on mask wearing, and social distancing. Have you been vaccinated yet? What do you want to know about the vaccine and its efficacy? Have you heard things about the vaccine that you want clarification on? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway is a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's Associate Director for Health Sciences in the Global Health Institute. Dr. Conway, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Great to be with you.
Well, you've been fully vaccinated now, got your second dose. What are you feeling? What was that experience like?
I have to confess it was more emotional than I had expected. You know, it's been a long time coming, and just the idea and the sense that there actually is a light at the end of the tunnel was really heartening. You know, and then getting the second dose and you know, feeling almost like a superhuman really has been pretty pleasant. But, you know, with that said, I've also realized that it's still double down time on the rest of our activities to try to prevent the spread of this virus.
Yeah, you know, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have effectiveness rates of about 95% after two doses. And isn't that on par with vaccines for like measles and chickenpox? That's really remarkable.
Yeah, these are really robust vaccines with really very strong immunity to prevent any severe or significant disease, you know, and we're starting to get more information that they probably also do start to whittle away at this asymptomatic infection that can lead to some of the transmission that's been so difficult to control.
So what do you know about how long these vaccines will work?
Yeah, that's going to be the question that still needs to be answered. I mean, that was the only thing that was, you know, sort of shortened up in the trials was looking at the durability of the immunity. I mean, we're already seeing data now that Moderna's vaccine has immunity that lasts out at least a year. You know, those two vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, were able to get started and out of the gates very quickly back in the spring. And so we've already got a decent amount of data now from those very early enrollees when they were just first figuring out the dosing. So we've got at least a year of immunity for those early enrollees, and they seem to be well protected still. And we would hope and expect that that'll persist for at least a few years.
So can someone who has been vaccinated still spread the disease?
Yeah, I think that there is evidence that at least some people still could be infected, although they would have a much, much milder case of the disease, that vaccinees still could be infected. But the hope is that the immunity that they get from the vaccine decreases the duration of time that they would continue shedding the virus if they are even mildly infected and give at least some partial protection. So, you know, it's not 100%. And certainly the vaccines, as you mentioned, aren't 100% protective, but they certainly are very solid and I think are going to have a major impact on circulation as more and more people are immunized.
Let's look at how this rollout has gone. We've heard this has been very sluggish. People are not getting them as quickly as possible as we, you know, move from the 1A phase into the 1B. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it was a little glitchy in the beginning. I mean, I don't think having it happen around the holidays made anything, you know, easier. You know, this was and is still a historic rollout in trying to do something both this quickly and this broadly. And, you know, at a number of levels, there were some issues. I mean, obviously, the first issue has been that there's been production issues, so that a lot of the numbers of vaccines that were promised by the federal government back in October and November just didn't come to pass. And then it was a matter of really trying to figure out a way, how do you get this vaccine allocated and distributed equitably? And so that was decided to be done by just the populations of the states. But then the matter of actually shipping and delivering the vaccine into the communities and then being able to schedule. And so I think it's been a little glitchy in the beginning. I think people are figuring it out. You know, the hardest part was that most of the states, when they would be promised vaccine, didn't always get what they were promised. But the downstream effects of that, when people would sort of think something was coming and then start scheduling people, then realize it wasn't available. You heard about that happening in Texas today on the news. You know, so that's the kind of things that have been, you know, gradually being worked out. But, you know, we do know that once it gets onto the ground and into each of the vaccinating facilities, then they're very quick about moving it. And I think the other piece of this that's been challenging is that the dependency on the healthcare systems initially, realizing that the capacity in the public health sector wasn't quite as robust as people wanted. I think people have to remember that the healthcare system is, not only trying to do this, but also taking care of all these COVID patients, as well as having their own staffing issues. So the idea that healthcare systems would be able to suddenly mobilize a couple hundred people as vaccine teams was a little bit of a stretch. So that's all being sorted out. Funding's coming now for public health to have more personnel. So I think that this is going to gradually ramp up and become more robust in the next few weeks.
Yeah, public health very taxed trying to now add another layer of giving vaccines. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. James Conway, a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We are talking about the COVID vaccine and its rollout. What questions do you have about getting a COVID vaccine? What do you want to know? What have you heard about the vaccine that you want clarification on? 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, you work on vaccination programs on a global scale. What have other countries done to stop the spread of COVID that you've seen?
Well, I mean, I think everybody around the world has adopted to some degree these ideas of social distancing and masking. And obviously, some societies are much more compliant and much more geared towards compliance than others. And so I think that's been the most important thing that has happened worldwide. Certainly restrictions on travel. And if you're an island nation like Australia or New Zealand, you can certainly restrict travel in a little bit more concerted way. But I think everybody's been, really geared towards trying to get programs available for vaccines. And we've seen that, not only do we have these two vaccines approved in the United States, but there's, a half a dozen other vaccines coming out of China and Russia. And then certainly the next wave of vaccines, including the AstraZeneca vaccine, are already available in some areas of the world. So, it's a worldwide effort to try to get vaccine. Obviously, there's still not adequate supply of those. But as those become available, more and more countries are certainly gearing up to deliver those.
Can you explain why a booster dose is needed and what the booster does?
Yeah, I mean, the idea with most vaccines that need a series of doses is that for the majority of these, the first dose is sort of what we call the prime, where you sort of prime the system and kind of teach the immune system what it's supposed to do and what it's supposed to recognize. And the booster dose basically is a reminder that essentially tells the immune system, yeah, we're really serious about this. We really do want you to make as much immunity against this pathogen as you can. And so, we know that for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, there's certainly some protection from the first dose, but that second dose is really what sort of tells the immune system, this is the real deal, and we want you to carry on this immunity further. And what stands to still be discovered and sorted out is whether these vaccines then need to be repeatedly boosted over years or more. And I think that's fairly common with many vaccines. We know that you need to get a tetanus shot every 5 to 10 years. Most vaccines are kind of rolled out not quite knowing exactly how long they're going to last. And then over time, we figure out when are those boosters needed.
Yeah, and we need a flu shot every year. I wonder if we will need a new COVID shot every year.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting questions is with these, ongoing mutations happening all over the place. I mean, that's the reason primarily that we have to get flu shots every year is that there's enough mutations and changes in the viruses as they circulate around the globe that the vaccine basically needs to be updated to provide you with the latest and greatest immunity against the currently circulating viruses. And so that is one of the things that we'll have to watch and see. Most of the vaccines are currently geared towards one part of the virus, what's called the spike glycoprotein. So far, knock wood, over the year of the circulation, those have been relatively stable. And so the vaccines certainly still look very good at neutralizing that virus. But if they continue to change, there may be a need to update the vaccines periodically. The other issue, obviously, is does the immune system need a reminder, and do we need to boost it periodically to make sure it remembers to stay as fully engaged as it is after the first couple doses?
Dr. James Conway, an infectious disease expert, our guide to fighting COVID with a vaccine. Have you had COVID? What symptoms did you experience? How long did you show symptoms? And clinicians, what are your patients asking you about with the COVID vaccine and how they fight the virus? What do you tell them? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Conway and your questions here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the COVID vaccine and developments in the fight against the global pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC says a new, more contagious variant of the coronavirus will likely accelerate spread. That variant is known as B117. It first caught scientists' attention in England last month. It's been detected in Wisconsin. We have Dr. James Conway at our side, Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison, and he's with us for the hour. Let's bring in Allison now in Rhinelander with a question. Hi, Allison. What would you like to ask?
Hi, I just want to know, does the measles vaccine prevent transmission? The COVID vaccine does not. So I'm wondering, is there some mechanism in it? Does the measles vaccine prevent transmission?
Yeah, interesting question. So, you know, each vaccine acts a little bit differently as far as what it does and which parts of the immune system it primarily covers. And so the measles vaccine, you know, is a live viral vaccine and really sort of develops the full range of immunity and is very great at not only protecting against infection, but certainly protects against transmission as well. The COVID vaccines actually probably do something very similar, even though they're not live. They're actually just a small piece of the components of the organism. It does actually produce both what we call B cell and T cell immunity. And so, you know, as long as it completely protects against infection, it will prevent against transmission. There are going to be, you know, similar more like to the flu vaccines, there are going to be some people that get mild infections and therefore can transmit. So the measles vaccine is particularly good at preventing infection. But with that said, no vaccine is 100%. And so occasionally there are people who get the measles vaccine who still get measles.
Allison, thank you for that question. Bree now is with us from Wausau with a question. Hi, Bree, go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Kate, and good morning, Dr. Conway. First, I would just like to say thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for the work that all the essential workers are doing right now during this pandemic. It's a terrible time, so I appreciate you very much.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. It's a privilege, actually, to be in this space, but you're right. It's been a challenging year.
Absolutely. Well, I would just like to ask a question. So my business closed as a result of the pandemic, and now I'm a stay-at-home mom, which has its benefits and is great. But how does somebody like me figure out where and when I can get the vaccine or if I'm eligible to get the vaccine? I know there's phases of it. What do you think is the best avenue for me to explore to figure out when I can be eligible to get it? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Bree.
Sure. And obviously, Bria, this is a question that everybody's got on their minds that, you know, have not been in some of these initial phases. You know, this is all still being worked out. And I think, you know, we're starting to see a little bit more organized planning at both the federal and now the state level for how this is all going to work. But the idea is basically to have groups that are sort of manageable at each phase of this to be able to make it feasible to figure out exactly who's in each group and to invite them and then have them scheduled. Because one of the things we have to realize is that, you know, we have to be cautious if we're going to try to do anything like mass immunization clinics. You know, we've been telling everybody not to cluster and gather in large gatherings. And then the idea of having sort of a hockey stadium or something where you have a couple thousand people all lining up isn't exactly the most palatable. So we're trying to figure out a way to balance that. But the idea is that as each phase comes up, that group then gets invited and hopefully is immunized through a collaboration between public health and the healthcare systems in each county within the state. So right now we're in 1A, which is healthcare workers like myself, as well as residents of long-term care facilities, nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities. And then we're going to start transitioning, and you're already hearing about it, to phase 1B. And phase 1B is going to include first responders initially who are not part of EMS, so that's going to be police and fire, and then is going to very quickly move into education and educators and the people that support them, including the school staff, as well as some other groups of healthcare personnel. And then the addition of mink husbandry is important in the state of Wisconsin. But the biggest group is really going to be what was originally going to be here in Wisconsin, the over 70 group, although you're here nationally, that they're going to actually probably try to make it into the over 65-year-old age group. So in Wisconsin, that's almost 1.5 million people that are then going to be in that next phase. And so it's going to have to require some serious coordination to try to figure out how to actually reach all of those people. Again, a lot of it's going to try to be done through people's healthcare systems where they have their primary care, their medical home. But there are substantial numbers of people who are not in a medical home at this point with one of those health systems. And so the counties are starting to develop these sign-up systems. And I believe there will be an announcement in the coming weeks that there's going to be a state sign-up system as well, so that people are in a database and can list what their particular grouping would be. And so we'll hopefully start to move from 1A into 1B, and then there will eventually be a 1C group as well. So that's the idea, is to sort of make these manageable groups that we can help coordinate.
Talking with Dr. James Conway, professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, discussing the COVID vaccine and taking your questions about it. Patricia is with us from Onalaska this morning. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. I'm so glad that you can take my question. I am allergic to neomycin, and I wasn't able to take the shingles vaccine because it had neomycin, and then they came out with a new Shingrix, and I could take that. Do you know if neomycin will be in these vaccines?
I do not believe. I would actually have to check to see specifically if neomycin is any of the coming vaccines. Currently it's not part of either of the vaccines that are presently available. You know, neomycin is basically an antibiotic that's added to some vaccines, especially those that are in multi-dose vials, to keep them sterile when there needs to be multiple doses within a vaccine, within a vial. But as far as I know, I do not believe that there is neomycin, but we could check that for you. There is at the CDC site a list of all the ingredients for all of the vaccines. But I think it is important for people. You know, I think one of the things that we've heard about is some of these reactions that people have to the doses. And they're rare, but, you know, I do think that one of the things we screen everybody for is when you would go in for your vaccine, there is actually a list of all the ingredients that's put in front of you before you get the vaccine to make sure you don't have an allergy. So for people like you, the system is actually well set up to make sure that we're not going to put you in any harm's way.
Let's bring in Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi. What is your question?
Good morning. My question is that it was noted months ago that the sickest people who had the virus seemed to be those whose immunological systems had gone into overdrive in order to protect them. So I'm wondering whether now, because many people perhaps already have a natural immunization, because they were exposed to a person who had the virus, that virus was spread, a person picked up the virus and became immune because even though they didn't themselves exhibit any symptoms. So now when these people go to get a shot of the new vaccine of one kind or another, is their system going to go into that overdrive because they already have been immunized naturally? And this would be true for either getting the first shot or the second shot. Is that going to cause their system, as I said, because they're already immune, are they going to be actually sicker?
Nancy, thank you. And let's let Dr. Conway sort through your concerns here.
Yeah, Nancy, that's an excellent question and one that's had to be very seriously addressed. You know, I think one of the things we know with both of the available vaccines is that there's more of a reaction to the second dose than there is to the first dose. And I think that makes sense in that the immune system has already sort of gotten its initial priming and it's sort of starting to get geared up. And so there is more likelihood that when then challenged again with that same stuff that is in the vaccine, that there's going to be a little bit more of a reaction because there is some pre-existing immunity. And we know that when the vaccine trials are done, people are excluded that have already had COVID infection as part of that. And so that's specifically something that's not easily addressed early on. And what we have seen is that for people that have had a recent documented infection, they do seem to have a little worse side effect profile for that initial reaction to the first dose. And that's one of the reasons that CDC and others have said that for people that have been previously infected, while they certainly are entitled and should get vaccinated, that they may want to wait 90 days after that infection to both, since they have some immunity, to spare doses for other people that may need them more, but also to give some time for that initial immune response to settle down. We do also know, though, that people that have very mild disease tend to start to lose that immunity much sooner than people that have had the full-blown disease that gets them hospitalized and things like that. That's one of the reasons that these plasma donations are primarily being people that have actually been hospitalized with pretty severe disease. So we know that people that have asymptomatic disease start to lose that immunity much sooner. Hmm. And so I think that 90-day window really does make sense for people that have had an infection. Your question, though, is for people that don't know they had it, you know, is how much of a concern is that? And I would say that they tend to have much milder and much more minimal immune response, and therefore their likelihood of having a problem with the vaccine is really much more diminished than those that had full-blown disease. So it's certainly something to think about. One of the things I have told everybody is that we all have an obligation, especially with a vaccine like this, to make sure that we do report all of those side effects so people can track those. And there's a very robust national program called the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, where anybody can report and should report so that those can be looked into.
And we have to modify. Yeah, we have to pause there with Dr. James Conway, and we will pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the COVID vaccine rollout, what you need to know here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Federal health officials released a modeling study Friday warning of a more contagious variant of the coronavirus that could become the dominant source of infection in our country in the coming months. And the study came as we are in a race to vaccinate people. Nearly 214,000 vaccines have been administered in Wisconsin as of Friday. It's according to the Department of Health Services data. What questions do you have about how long the vaccines will work and the booster? Do you have a history of allergic reactions or side effects? What do you want to know? 800-642-1234. We have pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. James Conway as our guide. Dr. Conway, as we were talking there about following up with people who have had the vaccine, you can actually enroll in this option called VSafe, I understand, the CDC smartphone tool that provides automated health check-ins after you get a COVID vaccine. Can you tell us, you know, should people enroll in that?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting and very helpful tool that was thought through pretty carefully. You know, the idea for a lot of vaccine trials is, you know, we look for the significant side effects at the immediate time of giving the vaccine. And then over the next couple of months is when most of the long-term side effects become clear. One of the things, though, that is important is looking at really what those side effects look like. And this is a way essentially for the public to almost crowdsource being involved in a massive kind of secondary study. You know, as each vaccine or each drug is developed, it goes through phase 1, 2, 3 of their trials as they kind of get bigger and bigger. And then phase 4, it's what's considered sort of the post-licensure ongoing surveillance, where all vaccines are continually monitored for how good they are and how long they last, and are there any safety things that people need to worry about. This is a much more robust way to do that, because this essentially gives everybody who gets the vaccines a chance to be involved. You know, we've given now over 12 million doses in the United States. And so, you know, I think we're getting more and more information on a daily basis showing, you know, for the vast majority of people, how incredibly safe these are, how well they're tolerated. And, you know, we're starting to move into a period of time now where we're starting to see some tangible benefits as areas like healthcare workers that have been vaccinated are starting to see less and less disease. So this is really a great opportunity for people to all participate.
Craig from Burlington called in, couldn't stay with us, and wants to know specifically what are the adverse side effects? What is becoming clear about adverse effects? And what can you say on that?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I would look at it kind of similar to what we saw with the Shingrix vaccine, which is that primarily it hurts a bunch for some people at the point of the injection, you know, some pain and swelling at the initial dose. A small proportion of people with that first dose get a little bit of fever, sometimes some chills and achiness, but most people within 2 days, with about 48 hours, those have resolved. And then the second dose, you know, is just a little bit more of that. It hurts a little bit more at the injection site. There may be a little bit more low-grade fever and a little bit of chills and achiness. And that's really, you know, the majority of what most people go through. And it makes sense that, you know, you're stimulating the immune system to essentially think it's had a mild version of the infection. And so those are the symptoms that people with real COVID, you know, but on a much more amplified level, mm-hmm. go through with the disease. And so it's a really mild version of essentially turning on the immune system to act like it thinks it's had the disease.
Let's bring in Eric now in Phillips. Hi, Eric. What is your question?
Yes. Hi, good morning. I know that both the vaccines that are authorized are a two-dose regimen. And in order to get more people having the vaccine, it sounds like there's talk of giving more people just a single vaccine. What's the downside or ramifications if we go that path for the people that don't get that second dose?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and that was sort of bouncing around a little bit. You know, I think that the risk is that you've actually then kind of temporarily given people short-term immunity that doesn't last particularly long. And, you know, I think what we worry about is that it gives people a false sense of security that they're sort of partially vaccinated, but start to think that they can actually behave a little bit more liberally as far as their activities. And again, the other risk is really shortchanging those people on being fully immune and having the durability of immunity that the two doses seem to provide. So I know people had proposed that, but both the companies and the leadership at FDA and HHS have sort of backed away from that. Now, with that said, there are some vaccines that are in the pipeline, and most importantly, the Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccine, where they're looking specifically at a one-dose versus a two-dose regimen. And so I think there could be, over time, some movement towards having vaccines that could be a one-dose. But I think for the current available vaccines, the data we have suggests that both of those doses are really important. And so I think over the last couple of days of last week, you saw most of the people kind of walking back from that suggestion. It certainly was proposed, and I think it was misinterpreted in the UK, that they said, you know, that they might temporarily get into a position where people might be delayed for their second doses. But I think it was misinterpreted. They never really intended that was going to be an intentional part of the plan.
Eric, thank you for that. Dr. Conway, should pregnant or breastfeeding women receive the vaccine?
Yeah, one of the great questions, you know, obviously they were excluded from the initial studies, but there's really no reason to see any risk to the majority of people in those situations. They have been included then in the guidelines to go ahead and be vaccinated, with the caveat that they should just make sure that they touch base with their healthcare provider to make sure that they're comfortable. I think the only people that we would have any real concern are people that already have a high risk pregnancy, where there's already concerns about the pregnancy. It would be people that might want to delay just because of the side effects and may get confused with the side effects. But other than that, both breastfeeding and pregnancy are not considered contraindications to these vaccines. And we know that COVID-19, you know, certainly in a pregnant woman is a bad actor, and they have much more severe outcomes than the average healthy person of that same age group. So, you know, we know that the risk is significant. I mean, if people can completely mitigate and have absolutely no risk for exposure, you know, then they might consider deferring. But for the people that are living a normal life in this abnormal existence we're all in, you know, this really does add an additional layer of protection for both mom and her new, unborn baby.
Let's bring in Wendy now in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. The question that I have is, my father is a transplant patient. He received a new kidney, and so is he going to be able to take the vaccine since he already has a compromised immune system?
Yeah, well, congratulations that he was able to get a vaccine. We thank everybody who's an organ donor, because that's such an important part of maintaining people's well-being. That group was not excluded from the initial trials, but they weren't actively sought out either. But we've now seen quite a few of them starting to be vaccinated safely. You know, I think, again, the thought is that as long as their condition is stable for about a 3-month period, that they should and can be vaccinated safely. And actually, the transplant professional societies are all coming out with very strong statements over the last few weeks and in the coming weeks, really pushing to make sure that those patients are protected. You know, again, they with a compromised immune system, if they get COVID-19, you know, can really get a very significant and very severe version of the infection. And so while the immune system gets turned on by these vaccines, fortunately, at this point, it does not seem that turned on immune system does anything to trigger any kind of rejection episodes for kidney transplants or other organ transplants. So they absolutely are going to be considered a very high priority group when we get into patients that have underlying comorbidities.
Even if they're on immunosuppressants following getting that transplant?
Yeah, so you know the immune suppressants may just diminish their immune response a little bit. They may not have a full immune response. But again, since these are non-live vaccines, these don't really pose any risk to people whose immune systems are suppressed. The only real issue is that they may just not get the full-blown immune response. But, you know, in these circumstances, something is certainly better than nothing.
Wendy, thank you for that. We're talking with Dr. James Conway, a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, taking your questions about COVID, about the rollout, and what these vaccines may look like in the future. Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, we heard from a grocery store worker from Appleton called in, couldn't stay with us, and they wonder when they'll be able to get vaccinated, grocery store workers.
Yeah, you know, it's been very difficult in trying to sort out, you know, how to put different people in front of the line and who's first and who's second. You know, I think we all appreciate those real essential workers who have, you know, taken one for the team, as we say, over the course of this pandemic and continued to practice their trades, even in the face of this pandemic. And so we're very eager to get that next wave. You know, when we looked at the original 1B group of sort of all of the essential workers, you know, and everybody that would be sort of included in this next phase, you know, it ended up being about 2.5 million of the 4 million people in the state of Wisconsin that are over the age of 18. And so, you know, I think the decision at the state level was, let's break it into manageable pieces. And so they kind of divided this 1B group into two pieces, sort of, you know, the piece one and piece two. So I do anticipate that as vaccine becomes more available over the next month or so, that we're hopeful that we should be able to move into that next group of essential workers, you know, within the next 4 to 6 weeks would be the hope. Again, it really depends on what the vaccine supplies look like coming from the federal government. And it's a little unsure exactly when and how the biggest loads of those vaccines will come. But I would certainly think that the grocery workers and others like that will be in sort of the second half of this 1B over the next couple months.
Dr. James Conway, our guide to the COVID vaccine distribution campaign, and we'll look at what mutations might mean in the virus. Have you been diagnosed with COVID? What symptoms did you experience? How long did you show symptoms? Were you hospitalized? What can you tell us about your recovery, inpatient and at home? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more conversation with Dr. James Conway here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. James Conway of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. More than 213,000 Wisconsinites have been vaccinated so far. To accelerate the rollout, Governor Evers announced Friday that the Department of Health Services and the National Guard will dispatch 9 mobile vaccination teams across the state this week. We heard from Jerry in Madison, called in, couldn't stay with us, wants to know, Dr. Conway, if you have a mild reaction to the vaccine or no reaction at all, does that mean it isn't working or was given to you improperly? What if you don't feel a change in your system? Jerry asks.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it doesn't mean anything bad about either the vaccine or how it was administered. It's just that, you know, everybody is very unique and there are some people who sail through it and, you know, barely notice anything. And there's others that, you know, do feel a little crummy for a couple of days. You know, having been one of the people that I was, I still feel privileged that I was in the front of the line because of my role as an infectious disease doctor taking care of COVID patients. And, you know, despite some of my colleagues, you know, claiming that they felt pretty crummy, I actually didn't feel particularly bad at all and didn't really even change my behavior. You know, so I think that everybody's unique. You know, what we're telling people is, you know, you have to know your own body and treat yourself. And, you know, I don't even think everybody needs Tylenol or ibuprofen with these vaccines. But, you know, if you do start to have reactions with pain or some chills, it's easy to sort of tamp them down with some of those products, analgesics and antipyretics, to manage the aches and the fever. So again, most of these people that are having these reactions, they're relatively mild. They're mm-hmm. well managed and easily managed.
John from Milwaukee called in and is wondering about timing. John is thinking about getting the shingles vaccine, and should they hold off? Is it okay to get the shingles vaccine close to when John will get a COVID vaccine?
Yeah, good question. And we do ask that people have a 14-day or more window of time between vaccines. You know, the vaccines as they were studied, you know, basically excluded doing them with other vaccines at the same time, with the exception of flu vaccines. And so, you know, one of the issues is really trying to make sure that we don't stack up the side effects. But also, you know, when your immune system sort of dealing with one thing, you don't want it to have too many things to deal with at the same time. So the ask is really to avoid a vaccine other than the COVID vaccine for 14 days before and after. So depending on which tier group he thinks he would be in, if he's going to do the shingles vaccines, you know, it's a two-dose series. He just needs to sort of space that out so he gives himself time to recover from each of them mm-hmm. and make sure that he has the full response to each of them.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's bring in Jerry now with a question. Jerry from Appleton. Hi, go ahead.
Thank you, Kate. Regular listener, first-time caller. Dr. Conway, I'm calling on behalf of my mom, who's 85. And for background, she had COVID this past summer and was quite sick for 5 weeks, including a hospitalization. And she's also an insulin-dependent but diabetic. About 15 years ago, she had a bad reaction to a flu shot. She actually fainted and needed an antidote of some kind, but the details are unknown. So the question is, with that reaction to a flu shot, should she be concerned about the COVID vaccine?
Yeah, I would say it would be unlikely. There's really not a lot of similarities between the flu content vaccine and the COVID vaccines. You know, with that said, we do take this quite seriously because, you know, as people are seeing, I mean, there are the occasional individuals who do have a little bit more severe reaction, and there have been some allergic reactions. And so one of the things that's very important is that every COVID vaccine recipient is asked and actually required to sort of sit tight for about 15 minutes afterwards, whether they're getting through a drive-through or an in-person vaccine site, to make sure that they can be observed and people can respond if they do have some sort of unusual response. You know, I'm pleased and I'm happy for your family that your mother recovered from all this. That certainly sounds like it was a rough one. You know, and unfortunately, the immunity from those infections, while it's pretty good for a while, it will probably wane. So she certainly is going to be high priority to get vaccinated, and I would encourage her to do so. But I think she should, you know, be reassured that we're taking it very seriously, and all of the vaccine sites do make people sit around for a while afterwards to make sure they're observed.
Jerry, thank you so much for that question. Christina now in Glenwood. Hi, Christina. What would you like to say?
Hi there. Thank you. I have a quick three-part question. What kind of socializing can be done once vaccinated? Is a non-vaccinated person safe to be with a person who has been vaccinated and vice versa? And do those that are vaccinated have to continue wearing masks?
Yeah, great question. And we get that a lot. You know, I think currently the ask is going to be that even those of us that have been vaccinated continue to behave as we have been in trying to maintain social distancing and all of those activities. You know, I think that while it is very likely that these vaccines are going to allow ultimately some change in behavior, you know, until we know exactly what the rates are of how often people do get asymptomatic or, you know, mild infections that are vaccinated and how much they actually can transmit and shed, I think the safest thing for all of us is just to sit tight and continue to act the way we have been. I think eventually, you know, what we're hoping is that we get enough people vaccinated, and between those that are vaccinated and those that have already survived and have some immunity, that we're going to get to the point of herd immunity, which is really important in diminishing just the rate of circulation in the communities. I think once we get to the point where we actually have seen a dramatic drop in the curve, as we say it, that we will be able to start to lighten up and loosen up on our activities. But right now, I think that the ask is everybody just sit tight and keep behaving the way we have been until we have enough information and data and enough people protected out there that we can start to change our guidelines.
Okay, and just for clarity, even though you get the vaccine and the booster, still wear your mask, still social distance.
I believe so. That's what I've been doing. I think it's the safest thing for those of us even who have been vaccinated. But also, you know, we still respect and owe it to our friends and colleagues that if there's a still a mild, you know, small chance that I may pick it up and be shedding, I still want to protect the people that I'm around. And that's, you know, that secondary purpose of wearing the mask is to protect others.
We're talking with Dr. James Conway of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, taking your questions on the COVID vaccine. Dr. Conway, we have been learning about this new strain, B.1.1.7. I'm, you know, wondering as this becomes more understood, this variant and others, will the vaccine remain effective as the virus itself evolves?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, Kate. You know, I think that we have to recognize that there are mutations happening constantly. And, you know, to be honest, they have not been monitored in all areas of the world regularly until more recently. And so we're starting to realize there's mutants all over the place. You know, one of the things that is going to have to be followed then is how much of those mutations change the area that the vaccine is directed towards, that spike glycoprotein. You know, the mRNA vaccines actually can be modified really rather quickly. And within a few months, they could actually be altered if necessary to match whatever new mutations happen. So I think it's just going to be, you know, an ongoing process. You know, I think it's a race to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible to hopefully shut down this B.1.1.7 mutation circulating. But if it does become prevalent or if it keeps changing, then we may ultimately need to keep modifying the vaccines like flu shots. But time will tell.
Let's look at children in all of this. Pfizer vaccine authorized for ages 16 years and above, Moderna's 18 years and above. When will children start getting this vaccine?
Yeah, both companies are moving into younger teens, now down to 12, and they're actually starting to also have studies enrolling 5 to 12-year-olds. You know, I think the big issue with the smaller kids is that they just need to figure out whether they need to modify the dose. I'm not sure that it's going to be one size fits all. And so the current doses, you know, if they do cause some side effects in big, healthy adults like myself, you know, maybe a smaller dose is more appropriate for the younger kids. So, you know, again, we take kids very seriously and certainly want to get them vaccinated, but want to do it very safely. So the studies are going to be ongoing over the next 6 months to figure out both what the right dose is and make sure that it's absolutely safe in kids before we move in that direction. So I would think by the end of the year would be the earliest we would start to see kids included in these programs.
And I wonder if a COVID vaccine might one day be part of a routine vaccination schedule for children.
Yeah, I could certainly see that the same way we moved gradually into introducing influenza vaccine routinely. You know, and there are even efforts at some levels to create combined vaccines so you could get a combo COVID and flu vaccine all at the same time. So I think, you know, the future is bright, actually. I think we've seen that science and technology actually can move quite quickly and yet do it very safely. And so I think that the future, in fact, actually looks quite encouraging, that there's going to be some really novel and important developments that come from this whole mess that we've all been in for this past year.
Well, Dr. Conway, thank you for joining us and answering questions.
Always a pleasure, Kate. And your listeners and your fans are really quite an intelligent and bright group of people. Those were great questions from all of them.
Yeah, they were. Dr. James Conway, professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.